Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With me on the roundtable this week is Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Welcome back, Morgan.
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. Welcome back, Andrew.
Good morning.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, there is party drama on both the GOP and the Democratic sides, but we'll start with the Republicans and the race for governor in 2026. The primary is a year away, and the Ohio GOP State Central Committee met on Friday and endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy. Here is Ramaswamy talking with reporters, calling his endorsement a major milestone.
And I think it reflects unprecedented unity in the Republican Party of this state. That puts us in an incredibly strong position heading into 2026. We're not going to take anything for granted. As I mentioned to the committee just now, we now move to a phase of this campaign where we're not just talking to the Republican primary base as it exists, but now growing that Republican base to win even more lasting and commanding majorities.
And in his remarks, which were about 6 minutes when he was talking with the reporters there, he also laid out his priorities on what he called Ohio's most pressing issues.
Some of those issues are familiar. Others have not been talked about as much as we should have. Issues like population decline, issues like a looming energy and potential electricity shortage in our state, issues like the educational achievement deficiency, not just in our state, but across our country. These are areas where I want Ohio to lead our region and, frankly, to lead our country in the path back to greatness.
So what did everyone here make of that endorsement? The Republican Party deciding to make an endorsement this early in the race, despite Governor Mike DeWine lobbying against endorsing early. Andrew, were you surprised?
No, I actually wasn't. But it was interesting, as somebody who's followed the Ohio Republican Party for a while, when DeWine was running for re-election in 2022, there's this whole raft of party activists who were very, very opposed to endorsements. And I wrote at the time that I viewed it more like opposition to DeWine. He's not that popular among his party. And it turns out, you know, or they said, oh, no, we just don't like endorsements. Well, they do like endorsements if they like who's getting endorsed. But I do think that, you know, we can talk about the significance of it from like a practical standpoint. But politically, I think this shows that the party establishment, President Donald Trump, and like the grassroots Republican activist types are kind of all on the same page here. And so I think that Ramaswamy is right that the party's more unified than you'd expect. I mean, I think that the final vote to endorse was like 60-3. And in order to issue the endorsement in the first place, they had to get 2/3 of the central committee. They got like, it was like 50-13 was the vote. So very much a sign of the party all being on the same page, including that endorsements are actually good if you like who you're getting, who's getting the endorsement.
And Karen, what do you make of the fact that DeWine seems to be losing influence over his own party?
Well, I'm not sure I'd read it that way. I mean, I think what a lot of this was about behind the scenes stuff was the question of whether Jim Tressel, the lieutenant governor and obviously former football coach, is going to join in that race. I think those who are hoping that he would jump into that race eventually, he has not made a decision, though he did say just a couple hours before that meeting that he had not ruled it out. So that certainly suggested that he's considering it. I think the idea of not having an endorsement obviously left that door open. And so that door, I don't think it's closed, but it certainly does send a message that the folks who were at that meeting, the State Central Committee, really like Ramaswamy in that role. What I think is really interesting is to look at, this is a party for decades. They had people who ran for office and you kind of waited your turn and then it was your turn to run for whatever. And here's Dave Yost, who was completely shut out of this endorsement. And, I mean, he's been in public office for a very long time. And we have a newcomer to politics who got this endorsement, along with the many other endorsements that he's been working on.
And, Morgan, who was there in the room? What was the vibe like in the room as this was being announced?
Yeah, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, I don't think it was a surprise for any of the reporters there that he ended up receiving it. There is a lot of enthusiasm around him. You know, he's a young face. He's a really, you know, charismatic speaker. When it comes down to it, he was able to give his stump speech to the room, whereas, you know, Attorney General Dave Yost, he was at a funeral for a Hamilton County law enforcement officer who was killed, you know, earlier in the week or the weekend. So he was down there. His wife, Darlene, gave his speech for him. But obviously, it's going to seem different. I think that when you know there's two candidates who are up, they were the only ones who were submitted for nomination. Jim Tressel was not submitted for nomination during this. It was pretty obvious, you know, it helps when you're there, but also the momentum behind Vivek, the amount of endorsements he's received versus Yost is just, I mean, it's significant.
Andrew, is this really early for this endorsement? I keep reminding myself that this election is not in November of this year. It is next year.
Yeah, it is rather early. Usually they'll wait until around the filing deadline, which is about 90 days before the election, to give all of the candidates a chance to kind of like come out of the woodwork and mm-hmm. do all their due diligence and stuff like that. But we saw in 2022, there was an open U.S. Senate seat after Rob Portman kind of abruptly retired. So there wasn't really the time to try to like clear the field. And so we had like six or seven candidates. It was kind of it was like a year. So I'm thinking about the timeline wrong. But regardless, it just played out differently where you had a primary just run for a long time. They spent lots and lots of money. J.D. Vance eventually won the nomination, but he'd had a bunch of negative advertising dropped in his head, reminding voters of things they didn't like about him. And it became a pretty close general election. So I'm sure like President Trump likes kind of flexing his muscles and showing that he can pick the winning horse and all of that stuff. But there is a practical reason for the party to want to avoid a contested primary like that. And like I said, there's sort of like a, you know, trade-off for voters. They don't get the choices that they would have. But in this case, it made sense for the party to do it this way.
Now, do you think Dave Yost will stay in the race? Does that make sense for him, Karen?
I don't think long term he will. I mean, he keeps saying that he's in it, but you're right. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to campaign against your own party, though. In this environment, who knows anything? I mean, like you said, it's a year away, this primary.
A lot
of things can happen. But I think certainly the signs could be pointing to his exit. However, you know, if Jim Tressel gets into the race, things could be really, really shaken up. I don't know if he's really considering it, though. I mean, I know, like I said, the night before, he said he had not ruled it out. But and he's doing some Lincoln Day dinners and things like that. But I wonder if those are going to start drying up as the party has already endorsed someone. And so maybe having somebody who could potentially jump into that race as well would not be somebody who would be a keynote speaker at a party event. So, well, I think the next couple of months, obviously, Yost is going to have to decide what he wants to do long term. And, you know, I asked him in an interview back in February, I think it was, if he wanted to maybe get an appointment for, you know, federal prosecutor or something like that. And he wasn't interested then. We'll have to see what happens.
I think he also, you know, his campaign manager sent out a statement almost immediately after the endorsement was made saying that their team is going to be taking the next couple of days to consult on how to move forward. So I guess we will see whether that happens now or whether that happens in the next couple of months, as Karen said.
And the Jim Tressel announcement the day before this decision was made, him saying that he wouldn't rule it out. I mean, there's a lot of people who would just assume, you know, like, was that Governor DeWine who wanted this delayed anyway, telling him to say that? You know, you're shaking your head because no one really knows. But that was just like the timing was weird, right?
I think it was intentional. I like to kind of just like make observations that I think are obvious, even if I don't have the like smoking gun connecting it. I mean, so we know that the governor was making calls trying to get the party to convince them to not issue an endorsement here. He wasn't calling for Tressel. He was just saying, you know, it's too early. Let's just give this a few months and let cool off a little bit. And then Tressel's, you know, statement coming out the night before, it's I think it's not that hard to make the connection. But, you know, does this mean that Tressel's really going to run? I mean, I don't know. But he's definitely been I think it kind of illustrates why we reporters have been kind of treating him as a de facto candidate, because mm-hmm. he is just kind of like looming there in the background. And so it's maybe more complicated than that. Tressel, I'm sure, is his own man. He has his own ideas. But I'm sure that, you know, back when DeWine appointed him lieutenant governor in the first place, it kind of seemed as if he could have appointed somebody who would not be a candidate of the stature that Tressel would be. Mm-hmm. So kind of it feels like his hand is in this whole thing, even if he's not coming out and saying it.
And I think it's hard for us to think of somebody who's in that position, lieutenant governor, who doesn't want to be governor. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's typically a position that somebody who wants to run or is trying to position him or herself for another office would want to be in. So I guess it's hard to imagine somebody who just wants to be there for 2 years and just then wants mm-hmm. to move on and go back to private life or whatever.
There's also the idea that he was chosen. He is somebody who's older, but he is somebody who would follow in DeWine's legacy. He would follow with the education. He would care about mental health issues. He basically would be, if for lack of better words, another type of DeWine candidate. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Jim Tressel, though, he has a lot of name recognition in the state. People love him. I remember last time I was on, we talked about how much people love him. When it comes down to it, he'd be able to raise the money from the DeWine-type fundraisers. Mm-hmm. But Vivek Ramaswamy, he clearly does not need help with money. And with that endorsement, having the sample ballots with his name on it, obviously that's going to be super influential. And the Trump endorsement. Let's not forget about that.
And let's not forget that there is another declared candidate in the race, Morgan County's Heather Hill. She's a black woman. She's decidedly a long shot. But was her name even brought up at the Central Committee hearing?
No. No, she wasn't there. I don't believe that she sought the endorsement that I know of anyways. But she was not considered.
Okay. Well, this is the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And when we come back from the break, we are going to take a look at the Democrats, who are now looking for a new leader for their party. And that is when All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and I'm Amy Jarovich on 89.7 NPR News. With me in the studio is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Morgan Trowell, Columbus Bureau Reporter for News 5 Cleveland, and Andrew Tobias, State Reporter for Signal Statewide. We spent the first segment discussing the Republican Party and their endorsement of Vivek Ramaswamy. Now we're going to spend the first part of this segment moving on to the Democrats. Before we talk about their leadership in the party, let's talk about former State Health Director Amy Acton, who is running for governor. Are there any new developments with her campaign? What have we heard from Amy Acton recently, Andrew?
She'll occasionally tout her fundraising numbers, which we have no way of really verifying because there's not a campaign finance filing deadline until the summer. But mm-hmm. she's kind of working the trail. You know, you'll see that she's appearing to Democratic activist groups. I think that it's not unusual for, I mean, we've spent so much time talking about Vivek Ramaswamy and all of that stuff. This is normally a pretty quiet period in the campaign where candidates are doing things like quietly getting their names out there, especially somebody like her who is known statewide, but she's never run for office before. So she's kind of introducing herself. So, but that's generally speaking, she's just kind of like working stuff behind the scenes.
And Karen, are there any developments in any other Democrat joining the race, or is Amy Acton going to standalone.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with who becomes the chair of the Democratic Party, because I know that there are two people who have expressed interest in it. You've got Bill DeMora, the senator for Ohio State, and he, I think, is not a huge Amy Acton fan. But then you've got Kathleen Clyde, a former state representative, who's now been endorsed to lead the party by Sherrod Brown. And obviously, Sherrod Brown is the big name in Ohio Democratic politics in terms of who many people say they'd like to see either run for governor against Ramaswamy or for U.S. Senate against John Houston, so who also got endorsed at the state central committee meeting. So I think that her, I mean, obviously she's out there, she's been out there, she's announced, she's campaigning, but I think that the future of the party's leadership does play a role here potentially in whether there would be a primary.
Now, the current party chairwoman, Liz Walters, stepped down. What reason did she give for leaving? Andrew?
So ultimately, she was offered and accepted a job as a CEO for Target Smart, which is a Democratic data firm that, you know, they sell services to campaigns to kind of know more about who they should target in the electorate and stuff like that. There is also a factor, I think, that she has her mother has kind of like a long-term illness. And so she has some like personal reasons that I think she's going to work from Akron still. So even though the company's in DC, so she won't have to be driving around the state in the same way that she would if she were state party chair. So her term was set to expire next year and she is stepping down early. But yeah, those are the reasons that she gave.
How long has she been the party chair? I don't even know how long a term is.
Since 2021, okay. Like pretty much right after the 2020 election.
Okay. And Karen, you went through a couple of the people who are interested in the position. Do the Democrats have to pick a party chair pretty quickly?
The vote is next month. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that Walter said in her resignation was that she feels leaving now gives whoever takes her place the opportunity to get their legs under them before the campaign really gets going for 2026. So it feels sudden like there's a vacuum in leadership there at the party, I guess. But that's an interesting point that does give whoever does take her place the opportunity to really start building up toward 2026, though there isn't a whole ton of time because, I mean, again, the Republican Party's already endorsed. You've got Ramaswamy, who's been out there campaigning for months now, as well as Yost. There's a lot of money to be raised and a lot of name recognition to be gathered in the next couple of months if the Democrats really do want to have a chance against these Republican candidates who, and when you start going down the ticket, the attorney general, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, all those folks are known to voters because they've been in, they're currently in office. So they're mm-hmm. just kind of moving around a little bit. And you're talking about Democrats who would not be potentially as well known. So.
And on the reporter roundtable last week, one of the reporters on thought that maybe Tim Ryan was floating the idea of running. Morgan, you've heard that.
Yeah.
No movement, though.
Yeah. You know, Tim Ryan, he is, you know, one of the bigger Democratic names in the state, and he's been floating it. I feel like he's floated a couple different options before. So we're going to see if he actually ends up putting his name forward. I think, like they already said, you know, it's going to depend on the party chair. It's going to depend on that kind of messaging. But, you know, he is known to voters. He was doing really well in the Senate campaign a couple years ago until it seems like kind of fell apart in the last couple of months before the election. But I mean, he performed well considering what he was up against.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. That was Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Andrew Tobias is with us, state reporter for Signal Statewide, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
I want to add something else on. I think whoever the party does pick, the Democratic Party does pick, it is kind of bringing up this whole issue of the divide among Democrats in terms of which direction do you want to take the party? Mm-hmm. Do you want to be more progressive and continue doing some things that there are more moderate Democrats who want to go a different direction, you know, which way do you want to go? When I interviewed Bill DeMora last week for our TV show, The State of Ohio, he was really pointed in saying that he really feels like whoever's going to be at the top of the ticket running next year needs to be a white man, which is an interesting thing to hear a Democratic candidate say, especially somebody who wants to chair the party. So I think that that whole question of what direction are Democrats going to take in Ohio, and then, of course, the larger question nationally is going to be a big factor in that.
Yeah, and there's another facet to that, too, where if somebody like Sherrod Brown runs, he first was elected office in the 1970s. You know, Tim Ryan was elected to Congress in 2000. Amy Acton's never held office before. And then there's also, you know, several kind of medium to big city mayors in Ohio that Democrats will talk about as possible future candidates. But when kind of faced with this choice in the past, we've seen the Democratic Party often kind of reach to the era of when they were kind of more competitive, and it's at the expense of potentially giving opportunities to future leaders. So it's a tough choice. They ran Nan Whaley in 2022, who'd never run for statewide office before, and she lost badly. So there's it's not like there's an easy answer, but yeah, it's kind of like, do they want to try to, you know, advance the future leaders of the party, or they want to try to get the people who've had the track record and who've won in the past?
So who makes this decision? Who decides who becomes the chair of the party? Is it a committee vote? Or
There's an executive committee. I forget how many people are on it, but you know, I'm actually not as familiar with the governance of the Democratic Party, but essentially there's going to be a party meeting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. You said it was, Karen, did you say it was within a month?
Yes, it's in June.
Okay.
June 10th? Right. Yes. June 10th.
All right. So. Well, then we'll know then. Right.
Yes.
All right. I wanted to turn to the primary election. Last Tuesday, we had an election. And in the words of one official from the League of Women Voters, the turnout was horrendous. the unofficial voter turnout count from the Secretary of State's office was 10.8%, so barely double digits. Was it just not enough high impact issues to draw voters to the polls? Poor messaging? What's your take on the low voter turnout?
I mean, that happens. That happens during these off-year municipal elections. They're normally really low turnout. I mean, yes, there was a statewide issue, but that was for a lot of different precincts. That was the only thing on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I mean, there were some school levies. There were some city council races. But other than that, I mean, for a lot of people, the only thing was issue two. I think they were pretty confused about issue two as well. It just kind of popped up. There was no official campaign for or against it. So I think it's not surprising that the election was so quiet. It's pretty typical.
So we don't need to worry about the future of our democracy, you know? it's not that bad.
I think it's frustrating that people forget that there are elections besides the presidential election. I mean, I think people have started to learn that there are elections for governor, for instance. But I mean, there are elections every year for something. And these odd year elections are for municipal races and like Morgan said, school levies, library levies, all these things that are really important. But people forget that this is happening because there's so much attention on the president and Congress and not as much attention on local races, which arguably impact people even more than what the president does.
The people who make the most impact on your day-to-day life are your local city council people and your state representatives and your state senators. I mean, those are the ones that impact you the most. But with all of the talk about Congress and the president, they don't impact Ohio on a day-to-day basis. That's just not what happens. So it's always frustrating for reporters. We try to get the message out that these elections are happening, but, you know, it's really an issue for the parties to deal with.
Yeah. And there, Columbus had city council and Columbus had a school board race. There were 10 candidates on there for that school board race. So, I mean, it's an important thing to remember.
Yeah, and issue two was really important too for local communities because this is a bond package that helps fund road, bridge, water, and sewer projects. And communities had said they need that money or else they were going to have to think about not doing those projects or raising taxes or doing something else. So this was a big deal for these groups. I mean, you had like 80 some government affiliated groups and unions and others that were supporting issue two, but the message just really didn't get out very much because people just...
But it passed comfortably.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the people who did come out to vote, that 10.89% that came out to vote, really... they knew what they wanted to vote for.
Yeah.
It was not... And a lot of them voted for issue two.
Yeah, there was brief talk that voters would confuse anything that had the word bond in it with the proposed bond proposal that involves the Cleveland Browns, but that's just because of the word bond. So that, I guess, didn't happen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are confused about how bonds work because they're complicated, you know. And but yes, that issue too had nothing to do with the Brown Stadium. That's in the House budget. We'll wait to see if that remains in the Senate budget or what happens to that.
Now, Morgan, you covered some school levies, which were a mixed bag. In Central Ohio, there were six levies in the Central Ohio area. Five failed. The only one that passed was Marysville School District. But you kind of looked at statewide results. There were more than 100 on the ballot. What did you find about school levies?
Yeah, overall, 70% of them, around 70% of them passed, which is really great for those schools. It really helps them, especially with what we're looking at with the budget. But for the schools that didn't pass them, this is going to be detrimental for them. I've talked with schools such as Parma in Northeast Ohio that has said, you know, this is, you know, the third, fourth time this one has failed. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to have to do is drastically different. They're going to have to put another levy on the ballot in November. A lot of these schools will have to put more levies on the ballot, or they're going to have to deal with not having that money, you know, cutting staff members, cutting school hours, requiring payments to participate in athletics. And when we look at what's going on with the House budget, when they are, you know, even though they say that they're adding more money into the budget, the expected money that they were going to get the schools is slashed by hundreds of millions. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the funding debate, you know, I asked Speaker Matt Huffman about should the state step in and help these schools. And he said, you know what? The voters said that they don't want to give money to this. Why should we be giving everybody's money to this? So it's going to be a challenge that these schools have to deal with.
And when it comes to the kind of levies that passed, I think is really interesting to note, because more than 86% of operating levies, renewal levies, were approved. 54% of new operating levies passed. So people seem to be interested in passing operating levies, but it was the bond levies, the capital improvement levies, those are the ones that really got hit very hard.
So that's like someone, they wanted to build a new building.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so those, I think only like 20% of those passed. So that's a really interesting way to look at things. And also, if you don't think your vote counts, remember that in the Madison local schools in Butler County, that levy vote was tied. So, you know, that.
Really?
Yes, it was
what
tied.
What did they do then?
Yeah, well, it's a recount then. Mm. But, you know, that shows that even when voter turnout is very low, and maybe even especially when voter turnout is very low, your vote does matter whether you want to pass a levy or not, or vote for something, vote for a candidate, whatever.
I think that's interesting, the operating versus the capital. So they want schools to continue as they are. They're like, we'll give you the money to continue what you're doing, but we don't want to fund you building a new building.
Well, I think when it comes to it, it's also the tax. You know, a lot of these operating levies, the schools will say, well, this is just a renewal, so your taxes aren't going to increase. Mm. Whereas the additional issues on the ballot, they could have caused tax increases. Mm-hmm. So I think really that is one of the differences between them. But we also got to look at the schools also had some libraries, and a lot, I think the vast majority of library levies passed.
All of them did. All of the library levies passed, which,
okay, you schools know, are controversial, but everyone loves the library.
And I think that's been a theme in Ohio for a long time, that people really do love their libraries, because you saw the reaction when library funding was not what DeWine had proposed. Mm-hmm. People got really, you know, ticked off about that. But when it comes to the schools, what's in the House budget, if that continues on through the Senate and gets signed, this is a problem that we're going to see a lot, because the House budget has this cap where school districts can only hold 30% of their cash reserves, and they have to give the rest back as property tax refunds to property taxpayers. And schools have said this is going to throw them into financial chaos. They're going to be constantly in the cycle of sending money back, asking for more money, sending money back, asking for more money. And so this problem, Ohio already leads the country in school levies. This is potentially going to be something we're going to see a lot more of.
A lot of fatigue.
Yeah.
Andrew, you want to add anything about schools? You're sitting there looking very pensive.
Sorry if I'm giving off the sort of pensive look. No, that was great. I mean, just one thing I'll say is that something that schools are going to have to deal with politically is that the property tax revaluation in 2022 sent a lot of people's values up. It reflects how the housing market got really hot. And so people are absorbing property tax increases just because their values went up. And so they're also being asked by their local school district, which is the vast majority of local property taxes, then it's hard. Like people, you know, like a couple hundred dollars a month kind of thing can make or break somebody, depending on what their situation is. So that's just going to be a challenge too that schools are going to have to navigate, is that on the one hand, they are getting more revenue from those increased valuations, but also their own expenses are going up. So in the future, they're going to have to compete with, you know, people, you know, being in that kind of environment where they're maybe less inclined to, you know, hand over more of their money.
Now, one final thing about Election Day I wanted to say was that on Election Day, Vice President J.D. Vance tweeted out to voters in Cincinnati asking them to support his half-brother, Cory Bowman, for mayor. And it worked. Bowman, a political newcomer, he placed second, and he was far behind the Democratic mayor incumbent there. It was a very wide gap, 18,000 votes to about 3,000 votes. But did Cory need his brother's tweet? Is that do you think that helped? Unfortunately, he doesn't have the last name Vance, so no one would really know that he is J.D. Vance's brother.
Well, and also Ohio cities, and this is pretty true around the country, are pretty Democratic. Mm-hmm. So it's not a surprise that the mayor of Cincinnati, Aftab Pureval, would have gotten the vote mm-hmm. that he got. I don't know whether J.D. Vance's name on the ballot would have made a difference yeah. among voters in Cincinnati? That's a good question.
I just love that the headline is that J.D. Vance's brother came in second place in the mayor's race, which sounds good until you see that the first place winner got 83% of the vote.
Yeah, yes, yes, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, the top two do move on, though.
Yeah,
that's true. When you look at it, it is definitely misleading when it says, like, oh, the top two, he got in the top two. It's like 11%.
Yes.
But, I mean, J.D. Vance's tweet coming the day of the election, I think, is also something to evaluate. He did not say anything, to my knowledge, before that. But also, I mean, Cincinnati, my colleagues at WCPO, they had been expecting this. You know, it is, at its heart, it's a Democratic city.
Had Cory Bowman run for anything, or is he? No. Okay.
I think that there had been some national interest in him, too. I think there had been at least one profile by one of the national papers or whatever. So there was some interest in him just because, you know, he's the vice president's brother.
Another topic to move on to. We talk about Larry Householder and Matt Borges for a minute. A 3-judge panel rejected the appeals of former House Speaker Larry Householder and former GOP chair Matt Borges. Morgan, what was the grounds for their appeal? What were they were appealing their convictions?
Yeah, so both of them were arguing, I mean, Householder had a lot more in his, but both of them were arguing that the jury instructions weren't clear. They were arguing that the sentencing was too harsh, and they were arguing that, you know, the state did not prove, or the federal government did not prove, that what they did was quid pro quo, or what they did was a bribe. Mm-hmm. The court said, absolutely, the prosecutors did prove that. The jury was not stupid. Everything was very clear. The appellate court was pretty clear that they did not agree, and they honestly they thought it was disrespectful. It is what it seemed to say in their ruling. Householder also argued that there was judicial bias, saying that federal judge Timothy Black was mad at him for 20 years ago. He donated to in opposition to his chance of being on the Ohio Supreme Court. The appellate court was like, that is absolutely not relevant here at all. And also, you deserve your 20-year sentence.
So what do you think will happen next? I mean, do you think that Larry Householder's team will appeal it again? Will it go to the Supreme Court?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I've talked with Larry Householder's civil attorney, Scott Pullins, who has said that not only will they be moving forward with this, but also that they're going to try to seek some form of clemency from President Donald Trump. I mean, he's saying that.
Oh, I thought they already did that.
Yes,
yeah,
but it's
nothing
so
happened.
Basically, that's a long process. What that comes to is typically you have to do that after 5 years of serving your sentence. Obviously, with this administration, things are more up in the air. Mm-hmm. But petitioning for clemency, that takes a really long time. I know that they have been saying that they're having conversations with the administration. They're talking because, you know, Poland said that Householder believes that this was politically motivated. And honestly, that could probably be a sympathetic argument for Trump, who also believes that a lot of the cases against him are politically motivated. Mm-hmm. So that is going to be an ongoing process. Who knows if that will come to fruition? But the appellate court did talk about how they would like the Supreme Court to evaluate some different cases on when it comes to racketeering and corruption and bribery, so to make it more clear what is a crime and what isn't.
And in the statement that Householder's legal team had, he name-checked Matt Huffman, Governor DeWine, former Lieutenant Governor John Husted, some other names in there, basically saying they did the same thing.
Yeah, there is an element to this case where it's a spectrum of what's kind of politics as usual and then what's, you know, a crime. And this is kind of at least fell somewhere between those two points. Like, obviously, the jury has their view on it. But something that was interesting about this ruling, and I'm not an expert on this, but there was a case that the U.S. Supreme Court heard involving a small-town mayor in Indiana. And in that case, it was something like he received a payment from a company that got a trash contract for the city that he ran. And the court ended up finding that because I think they called a retainer, had some kind of like technical component to it, where they found that it wasn't explicit enough to actually be a bribe. It was for services rendered or something like that. And so in this case, in other cases like it, it's going to be up to the courts, I guess, to decide how explicit does something have to be a quid pro quo in order to be a bribe. And I know from talking to David DeVillers, who is the U.S. attorney who brought this case, he's not in office anymore, he would talk about how he tried cases in the post-Soviet Eastern Europe republics where he would talk about how it's not like I will give you a suitcase of money and we have an agreement and I'm bribing you and you will vote this way. That it's more kind of, it's like a wink and a nod. And so then the court is going to get into the nuts and bolts of how much of a wink and a nod. And so the fact that they upheld the conviction here, when there is some element of ambiguity to it, suggests that kind of it's more in the vein of not loosening bribery laws.
A wink, a nod, a steak dinner, lobster bisque, and some tickets to the World Series. Okay.
Sounds good to me.
Well, that's what Andrew just referenced is the case that, one of the cases that the appellate court issued when they talked about the Supreme Court. They want them to evaluate those type of cases to make sure that people like Larry Householder are considered as taking a bribe.
All right. Well, this is the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the state budget a little bit, and we're also going to talk about why nurses showed up at the State House. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarevich. With me in the studio, Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide, Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Now, Karen, I mentioned last week on the Reporter Roundtable that not a week goes by that this Steelers fan doesn't have to ask the Reporter Roundtable about the Browns getting a new stadium. So I, even though nothing concrete has happened in the past week, I feel compelled to ask you, what is the latest on the Cleveland Browns getting a new stadium?
Well, again, this is in the Senate, the budget, it passed the House budget. It's in the Senate now. We're not hearing a whole lot coming out of the Senate. I think they've been very tight-lipped about what they're considering. Every time I ask about anything, it's always we're considering various options. We're discussing. I hear they're not even having a whole lot of meetings with stakeholders and things like that. They're really keeping the budget process pretty closed. We should, I think, though, the deadline is Friday for amendments, so we should start hearing some new information about what might be in the Senate version of the budget maybe next week. But so for right now, it looks like the thing that was in the House budget is still there. It's still being discussed. And even though there are multiple memos that say that this is not a good idea, it's not a good investment for the state, the Browns have continued to maintain that those are the wrong conclusions, and that this will return $1.3 billion more than the $1 billion the state will need to pay back the $600 million in bonds that they will give for the Dome Stadium in Brook Park.
Since you said you're a Steelers fan, I want to drag this out a little longer.
great.
I'm a Browns fan, unfortunately.
you said it.
Me too.
in Cleveland, kind of making the rounds, there was a rendering that the Haslam Sports Group produced for what would it look like if they redid the existing stadium on the lakefront. You know, organizations will release renderings to get people excited about, you know, an architectural plan is not that great, but ooh, look at the rendering. Look at the people walking around. And so that's kind of making the rounds in Cleveland, is the rendering that was never released before of the idea of the renovated stadium.
But the Haslam, they don't want to do that, right?
Right.
No, so they didn't put it out. Somebody else kind of you know, leaked it to the media.
But you do have Cobb County Executive Chris Ronayne and Justin Bibb, Mayor of Cleveland, that both now want the state to give the money toward a lakefront project. And Speaker Matt Huffman has said, I told Chris Ronayne the same thing I told the Browns 2 years ago, which is come back to us with a proposal that holds the state harmless or makes the state money, and then we'll talk about it. So he's really shut the door on the state providing some funds for a lakefront project for the Browns. So the momentum had been for the Browns to do this domed stadium development in Brook Park. And that, of course, means that they'd move out of that lakefront stadium and leave that kind of open to redevelopment or whatever.
Now, did Matt Huffman say anything about the Bengals when they asked for money?
Same answer, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, he says it, the way that he's positioning it, it sounds like he told the Browns, come back to us in 2 years with a proposal, kind of justifying what the proposal was that they came to the legislature with, the $600 million in bonds that would fund this dome stadium and surrounding development, but not in downtown Cleveland, in Brook Park, which is, you know, 12 miles outside of downtown Cleveland.
All right. Well, we'll be sure to talk about it again next week. I'm sure there'll be more.
Well, and there's, you know, when you start just the last week, there were numbers that came out from the Office of Budget and Management on tax collections and things like that. That's another thing that really is potentially something to watch, because you did have income tax collections that were way down, but you had auto tax sales that were way up. The question is whether those auto tax sales were way up because people were trying to avoid tariffs, and whether the personal income tax collections were down because there's an economic thing happening. There's a downward trend or whatever. So those numbers are going to play a big role potentially in what happens with the budget negotiations as it goes forward.
Well, another issue I wanted to bring up is Attorney General Dave Yossoff has last week accepted the title and summary of a proposed constitutional amendment to abolish taxes on real property. So what does this exactly mean? They want a constitutional amendment to say no more property taxes? Is it that simple?
It really is that simple. Usually these things are way more complicated than that, and there are determinations that officials have to make in the whole approval process for these things. But no, that's it. They just want to abolish them.
So how will schools be funded without property taxes?
They'll have to figure it out.
They don't.
That's a really good question.
So the people, who's putting this forward? Whose idea is this?
It's a group in Cuyahoga County. I think it's also kind of just a grassroots movement all across the state. People are really, really fed up. I think that we got to look at, you know, both sides of this issue of, yes, people are facing really high property taxes. It is really difficult. People are getting priced out of their homes. It's incredibly sad to see. But then if you're eliminating property taxes, Ohio, we're pretty low in a lot of our other taxes. I mean, our income tax, and, you know, we don't have tourism like Florida does. We don't have those type of things. So I understand, and it makes a lot of sense why people want property tax reform, but there's also the state could be doing. They have a whole commission dedicated to property tax reform. Have they done anything? No. Have they done anything substantial? No. But when it comes down to this, I mean, schools, they're with a cut in school funding across the state, with levies failing, I mean, we have no idea what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, it would be financially devastating to schools, just to kind of put a fine point on it. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's the majority. It's billions of dollars of property taxes go to schools. It's the vast. It's the main source of income for them. So, you know, we'd have to see. Will voters approve income taxes? There are some school districts have income taxes. Will lawmakers come up with some other funding proposal? But it would just be a huge tax shift. And there is, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, who we talked about at the beginning, who's running for governor next year as a Republican, has floated abolishing property taxes. I mm-hmm. haven't, frankly, I don't think it's a serious enough idea at this point to have fully explored it at this phase. If he talks about it more when the campaign is ramping up, I think me and other reporters will have more time to kind of dig into it and stuff like that.
But, and this is not going to be on the ballot right now. I mean, there's a yeah. lot of steps they've in got, the process. Yeah.
They've got, it's a constitutional amendment, so they have to get 443,000 valid signatures, which is a huge amount. Mm-hmm. Now, I doubt that they were aiming for this fall's ballot because the ballot deadline to file those signatures is in July, and that's just... to try to get that number of signatures in that short a time frame is just really very, very difficult to do. But it's interesting to hear Ramaswamy talk about property taxes. For a while, he was saying we need to go to zero income taxes and zero property taxes. He's still saying...
And then where's all the money come from? Yeah,
well, and that's a really good question. He's still saying we need to go to zero income taxes, but he's kind of backed off a little on the property taxes and maybe talking about capping them or something like that. But yeah, this is these are serious proposals because it's schools, it's law enforcement and libraries and all of these local entities that look to property taxes for funding. If you get rid of property taxes, which sounds great, well, then what do you do about those other things, which also, I mean, schools are in the Constitution. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, so just to help people understand the process. So this is a group that's collected 1,000 valid signatures. You know, they now are allowed to collect, there's a step in the road, but they'll be allowed to collect the 443 signatures they have to get, and they have to get them from at least half of the counties in the state. They have to get a minimum number, so it's very difficult. This is why this costs millions of dollars for kind of the most sophisticated ballot campaigns, because you basically pay people to go get the signatures. Mm-hmm. And the signatures have to be valid, so you have to get them fast enough that people aren't moving and invalidating the signature that you have on file. So I think it's very, very, very unlikely that this will proceed to the ballot unless they get a big financial benefactor to basically kickstart the whole thing. It will be interesting to see if it does motivate lawmakers to take this a little bit more seriously, if they know this kind of thing is looming in the background. But if nothing else, like Morgan said, I think it reflects this kind of like broad discontent with property taxes going up because of the valuation increases we've seen.
So it's kind of a push being like, okay, lawmakers, you won't do anything with it. You have this committee that's doing next to nothing. And so therefore, we're going to just go around you.
We've seen that happen in the past.
Yes,
where
I was just going to say.
These types of campaigns, typically, like if they have union backing or there's real money behind it, will motivate lawmakers to get off their butts and do something about X issue. So perhaps that's something we'll see here.
And also, we've seen when there were successful issues like for casinos, for instance, and, you know, lawmakers had opportunities to do something about casinos and chose not to. And we saw, what, 4 gambling issues that came to the ballot. And finally, voters just said, OK, fine, let's have casinos. And then lawmakers then had to deal with the impact of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if lawmakers want to retain control over what happens with property taxes, then
it kind of reminds me of the marijuana legislation
too.
And abortion. Voters, all the things. This is the way for voters to say, hey, you're not doing what we want. We're going to take it into our own hands.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes left. Karen, we've seen a lot of people show up on the State House lawn recently, a big group of school teachers, but most recently nurses were the latest group to show there trying to get lawmakers' attention. They're concerned about staffing ratios and violence in the workplace. What specifically does this nurses group want lawmakers to do?
Well, the legislation that they're looking at has been out there for a while. The whole idea of making sure that there is an appropriate staff ratio for nurses versus patients, because they say that they can't complete the kind of quality care that patients deserve if they're struggling with having to manage a huge patient load. And so there's that, plus the workplace violence issue. This is something even that we saw a lot during COVID, where people got angry at what their healthcare providers were telling them, and nurses got really worried. I mean, a lot of nurses are women, and so it's concerning, but not all nurses are women. So you've got male nurses out there who are advocating for the same things too, but these are things that have been talked about for a while, but legislation really hasn't moved.
So the state sets the ratio, patient to nurse ratio?
Well, that's what they want the state to do, is to set an appropriate ratio that they think would make sure that patients have the care that they need and that nurses have a little bit more support. I think a lot of it, I think there's a real feeling that there's not a lot of support for healthcare professionals in general, but especially for nurses who do a tremendous amount of work.
And well, I think also healthcare professionals, they're also worried about Medicaid. They're worried.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. So we have 2 minutes left if you want to tackle Medicaid in 2 minutes.
I'll be brief. Yeah. I'll be brief. I mean, tackling Medicaid in 2 minutes is hard, but I'll say in a couple quick sentences, basically with federal and state government talking about trimming Medicaid, Medicare, a lot of smaller hospitals, they actually get a lot of resources from Medicaid. When it comes to this, with the trimming of Medicaid or with the cutting of Medicaid, they're worried that this issue will only be made worse, the issue of the ratios. So when it comes down to it, they're asking for Medicaid to stay the same and for ratios to be added so that they're safe in the workplace.
You did Medicaid in under 2 minutes. So now I have a minute where someone, you have to tell me, what are you looking for this week? What are you going to be covering this week? What's coming up? Andrew?
Well, it's Monday. That's a big question. Yeah,
right.
I mean, the ballot board will meet on Wednesday to deal with the property tax amendment that we were discussing. They'll essentially decide whether it's one issue or not. And then if they do, which they should because it basically is, then they'll get the green light officially to try to collect those 443,000 signatures.
All right. So Andrew's going to cover the ballot board. Morgan, what are you going to cover this week?
Oh, I'm going to cover something about schools. Something about schools, something about, you know, maybe marijuana-related, hemp-related. We're already seeing something come out of the Senate with hemp, so probably something around that.
All right, Karen?
And I'm still checking into a bill that could be coming forward about iGaming and iLottery, allowing you to play casino games, video poker, and iLottery on your phone or on your laptop. So,
are you not allowed to do that?
Not in Ohio.
I don't do that. I didn't know.
Yes. So you can sports bet, but okay, this would be a little bit potentially another revenue source for the state.
We'll have to talk about that more because I don't know what that is. So we'll learn it. Listeners, join us next week. We'll make sure to have that in there. This has been the Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thank you, Karen Kassler with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Great to be here.
And Morgan Trowell with News 5 Cleveland. Thank you.
Always fun.
And Andrew Tobias with Signal Statewide. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.